It's Monday, September 29th, 2014. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Thai food, it's delicious. There's a committee affirming that. It's called the Thai Delicious Committee. This is financed by the Thai government. And here is their latest project. They developed a, quote, intelligent robot that measures smell and taste in food ingredients through sensor technology in order to measure taste like a food critic. In other words, the former prime minister of Thailand would travel around and say, this thing you label Thai food, it's not real Thai food. Let's find a way to ascertain that something is Thai food. Answer, a robot. They feed the robot food and the robot comes back and says, yes, it's Thai or no, it's not Thai. And I was thinking it would be great if we could apply this technology not just to Thai food, but to the Olive Garden. We need to figure out if the Olive Garden is really authentic Italian-American cuisine. So what better way than to build some robots, maybe with some guys from Bensonhurst or Canarsie, and these could be the Italian sensing Italobot 2000s. Here, let's feed some Olive Garden food to the Italobot 2000. Yes, the lasagna frittata is an abomination. My taste buds do not like this at all. The smoked mozzarella fonduta is too many cheeses at once. And the spicy shrimp scampi frita says shrimp twice. Shrimp scampi means shrimp. Shrimp does not compute. Okay, what I was doing there was I was merging the robot accent with the Italian accent. Now, I want you to know, I had first tried to do this with bagels, and listen to what I got when I did that. This thing is way too fluffy. It is not very good. You call it a bagel. It's like round white bread. And I realized I was doing Jackie Mason. Jackie Mason is a Jewish robot. Why do you call me a robot? Does not compute. On the show today, we'll be speaking about the shape of things, not the boot of Italy, but the boot of Louisiana, and maybe why it shouldn't be a boot. The history of the world in 10 objections. But first, Eric Holder resigns as AG. Let's talk to the guy 2 attorneys general ago. Last week, Eric Holder announced he would be stepping down as the country's 82nd Attorney General. His tenure was marked by some achievements in sentencing and an attempt to hold the line against erosion in voting access, but it was also very heavily criticized. The Fast and the Furious gun program, the aborted attempt to try Guantanamo Bay detainees in New York City, and a comment about the U.S. being a nation of cowards when it came to race. But you know what? Almost all recent attorneys general have been criticized quite heavily. More so, I'd say, than any other cabinet position. The Secretary of State gets partisan flack, but nothing like the AG. The Secretary of Defense largely dodges it. Even the Vice President isn't as heavily criticized. A dyed-in-the-wool conservative might roll his eyes at mention of Joe Biden, but he flares his nostrils if you say Eric Holder. And think back to Ronald Reagan. His vice president, George H.W. Bush, wasn't loved by Democrats, but his attorney general, Ed Meese, was loathed. Joining me now is the 80th attorney general, Alberto Gonzalez. He served George W. Bush, and he's now dean of Belmont University's School of Law. Hello.
How are you? I'm good to be with you.
This week, I heard so many people say of Eric Holder, especially his critics, you know, he doesn't serve the president, he serves the public. And that's true. It's true on paper. But I'm going to ask you, like, come on.
Let me just interrupt you there. Yeah. I think what people lose sight of the fact is the attorney general wears 2 hats. He is the chief law enforcement officer of the country. He does represent the United States in court. However, he's also a member of the president's cabinet. The president has a law enforcement agenda, law enforcement policies. And being a member of the president's team means that the attorney general is expected to move, carry out the president's agenda. So people lose sight of that fact. That's two important distinctions there with respect to the duties of the attorney general.
Yes, that exactly is what I was intuiting when people were saying he serves the public. I thought that was being used as a little bit of a cudgel. Now, how did you come to see the role? I mean, was it more like you were the captain of an aircraft carrier, big and large, and you could do a lot of damage, but it wasn't exactly nimble? You weren't running SEAL Team 6 there.
Well, that's certainly true. You have 105,000 people that work at the Department of Justice, less than 1% of political appointees, meaning the remainder are career people that some may not even care about the president or the president's policies or the AG or the AG's policies. So there are limitations about what you can do when you, you know, given the size of the organization. And so you set forth, you know, some key priorities. You try to establish a culture and expectations about what you expect of everyone who works at the department, and you do the best you can.
Did you ever feel jealousy of state attorney generals who have much less power and yet do have, it seems to me, more of a power to freelance, to set their own agenda, to be their own man or woman?
Not at all. In fact, we tried to establish good relationships with all the state AGs. And every state's going to be different. When we talk about the power and authority, the flexibility vis-a-vis the federal attorney general and the state attorney generals, states are all different. Here in Tennessee, for example, the Supreme Court decides who the attorney general is going to be. And that's kind of, that's very different than Texas, where I grew up, where the attorney general runs statewide in a partisan election.
You know what? Because I'm going to keep this on a civil level, I could make a crack about the U.S. Supreme Court deciding who the president's going to be. But we all know they didn't actually literally do that. Okay.
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 That's true.
Okay. One of the things that Eric Holder was criticized for was his discretion, prosecutorial discretion, on things like drug use and gay marriage. Now, setting aside the actual specifics of what he chose to prosecute and not, is that a proper role for the attorney general? You have resources, and either you could go after some things strong or some things not as strong.
Well, again, every attorney general has discretion in terms of which kind of cases are going to be prosecuted. That discretion is going to be informed by budgetary constraints. It's also going to be informed by policy priorities of both the Attorney General and the President of the United States. And that's why you have different administrations focus on different kinds of crimes, for example. So I think it's perfectly appropriate for the Attorney General to set those kind of priorities and policies.
Would it be a good thing if Guantanamo Bay were closed in our lifetime?
Yeah, absolutely. And President Bush wanted it closed. And we tried to close it. We tried to give him options to close it, but we never could come up with a good option in terms of how do you deal with these individuals who still remain dangerous. And I don't know whether or not President Obama got bad advice from his advisors or ignored the advice, but I think to come out publicly and say, I'm going to do something without knowing how you're going to do it, I think is a mistake. You never want to put the president in that kind of position. But let me reassure your listeners that President Bush wanted to close Guantanamo also. Don Rumsfeld did not want to be the world's jailer. So it's something that we wanted to do. We just couldn't find a good alternative.
Eric Holder has been criticized from the left for essentially carrying on John Ashcroft, Alberto Gonzalez, and George W. Bush's a lot of your decisions, a lot of your policies. When you hear that criticism, does a part of you say, see, it wasn't as radical as it was painted back then?
You know, when you actually assume office, you realize that you have a responsibility to protect our country, and as long as you find a way to do it under the Constitution, that's what you're going to do. And so, you know, I publicly have applauded President Obama for continuing many of the same Bush policies, and I support the Department of Justice continuing to give the advice that those policies are constitutional and legal. Obviously, they're effective, otherwise we wouldn't continue to use them. From my perspective, it's all about protecting America. And so how can we do that effectively? How can we do it legally? And I support this president's efforts to do that.
Now, one of the things that Eric Holder was criticized for was not even a policy. It was a speech he made early on in his administration. I'd like to read you the context of that whole speech, because what everyone is pointing to is this one phrase. And you'll hear the phrase: though this nation has proudly thought of itself as an ethnic melting pot in things racial, we have always been and continue to be in too many ways essentially a nation of cowards. He immediately went on to say, though race-related issues continue to occupy a significant portion of our political discussion, and though there remain many unresolved racial issues in this nation, we average Americans simply do not talk enough with each other about race. It is an issue we have never been at ease with, and given our nation's history, this is in some ways understandable. And yet, if we are to make progress in this area, we must feel comfortable enough with each other and tolerant enough of each other to have frank conversations about the racial matters that continue to divide us. Now, would you disagree with that?
No one wants to be called a coward, first of all. And there may be a number of reasons why someone doesn't want to talk about race. It has nothing to do with being afraid to talk about it. So I can understand why people might be offended by the use of those words. I do believe that we still have issues about racial discrimination in this country, and I think it is worthwhile. I think we should be talking about that, and what are the reasons for that, and how do we solve that? So in that sense, you know, I don't disagree with General Holder raising it as an issue, I might have chosen a different phrase than the one that he used that has offended some people.
That's true. But when you hear the full quote, I think, you know, you begin to appreciate the overall message that he's trying to make as opposed to the few words taken out of context.
But nevertheless, you know, someone's calling you a coward.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't like being called cowards.
That's
so
true.
That's a loaded word. And again, I think the Attorney General could have used another phrase, another term, and still been effective in delivering his message.
I got you. So it's a little bit of a uniter, not a divider thing going on there.
Exactly.
Well, thanks for your time. Alberto Gonzalez, Attorney General under George W. Bush. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
BP may be on the hook for $18 billion after the cleanup of its Deepwater Horizon oil spill. The cost of that spill is approaching $50 billion. When we think of disaster in the Gulf of Mexico and that region, we think of BP, we think of Katrina. But an ongoing disaster is more subtle and in some ways more damaging. It's the erosion of the coastline. One reason that we don't notice this as much, especially if we're not a Louisiana resident, is that when we think about Louisiana, we think about the map of Louisiana, and we think about the boot. We think about that solid boot shape, the lower right of which is as drawn in, if a bit jagged, as any other part of the state or any other map. But that does not reflect reality. And in an interesting and long piece in Medium.com, Brett Anderson, a Louisiana-based reporter, talks about this. The article is called Louisiana Loses Its Boot, and Brett's here with me now. Hello, Brett.
Hello, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. How important is the boot, the shape of the boot, to a Louisianan?
In the piece, I explained that it's as close as the state has to an official logo, or to an unofficial logo, I should say. It is, I think, important to folks in that it's all they've ever known. If they're proud of the state, they know the boot. They have the bumper sticker on their car. They have its shape is on baseball hats or on T-shirts, and the shape is all over the state on its highway signs. So, you know, I think it is important in that regard. But one of the things I wanted to explore in this piece is whether or not it could be changed, whether or not it would be reasonable to argue that it should be changed to reflect the toll that coastal erosion has taken on the state.
But it's not as if that map was accurate for any length of time. I mean, such as the state of wetlands that, you know, whenever you drew it a week later, it would actually look different, more so than Kansas.
That's true. I mean, all coastal areas are very difficult to map, you know, with exact accuracy. The unique part of Louisiana, in particular southeast Louisiana, where the Mississippi flows into the Gulf of Mexico and where New Orleans is that it's eroded at a much faster rate than just about any place in the world. And this has to do with having levied off the Mississippi River and controlled its path, which has deprived the wetlands around New Orleans and in this part of the state of the sediment that naturally rebuilds the wetlands and did build this entire part of the state over the centuries.
And I think the stat that you quoted in your piece is between 1932 and 2000, so this isn't even the last 14 years, 1,900 square miles of land were lost, which is like the state of Delaware, which is its own state that appears on the map. Imagine losing the state of Delaware dropping into the Gulf of Mexico.
And it's something that, as residents of the state, we've heard about again and again, particularly in the years since Hurricane Katrina. Politicians talk about it all the time, the fact that we're losing a football field or roughly a football field worth of land every hour, and that we've lost the equivalent of the size of land, the size of the state of Delaware, since the 1930s. It was after hearing these statistics again and again and again that actually a friend of mine, a colleague where I work at the time, speaking in New Orleans, Jeff Duncan, who's a sports writer, started asking questions about, you know, why is it that the boot hasn't changed? If it is true that we've lost the state of Delaware, if it is true that we're continuing to lose a football field every hour, why hasn't this image of our state changed? It has to, in reality, it has to be much different than what we see.
And so what'd you find out?
Well, I found out that map making is incredibly complicated and that it is true that the boot that we see, that symbol, I would say is grossly inaccurate. The heel of that boot has been eroded to the point where I think it's fair to, that it doesn't look like a boot anymore. Its toes look as if it's been caught in a bad lawnmower blade accident.
Other than, you know, the northern parts of the state, which are closer to Jackson, Mississippi, all southern Louisiana seems to be getting eaten up by the Gulf of Mexico.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. And you have to remember that there is a lot of oil and gas activity in that part of the state as well. You know, the erosion problem in the state isn't entirely because of levee off of the river. I drove the southernmost highway from New Orleans to Texas when I did the story. And in that path on the hill, you know, the landscape is filled with oil wells and oil rigs. When I went out onto a beach one day, my wife and I, just to sort of take in the view, it was literally, I couldn't count all of the rigs that I saw. It was too many, and some were hazy. I mean, it was as if there was a city just off the coast.
Well, and so this is hard to chronicle, but at least I think I'm getting by implication that if there are interests who are against changing the maps, maybe these are some of the interests.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's no doubt that, you know, oil and gas industry has a lot of influence in Louisiana. I mean, there was a lawsuit that was brought about by a levee board here in New Orleans that has sort of dominated local news for over a year now, trying to sue 97 oil and gas companies for the damage they caused the wetlands here. And, you know, the governor of the state and a lot of the politicians have taken every measure they possibly can dream up to kill that lawsuit so that it does not go in front of a court. And, you know, my idea with this, if the state did change the way that its symbol looked in all of its official materials, that it would generate conversation and awareness around an issue that I feel is of great national importance, but that is not really seen as such.
Brett Anderson has written for Medium.com an article called Louisiana Loses Its Boot. The boot-shaped state isn't shaped like a boot anymore. That's why we revised its iconic outline to reflect the truth about a sinking, disappearing place. We should credit photographer William Widmer and illustrator Matthew Woodson for bringing the article to life. Thank you, Brett.
Thank you, Mike.
And now the spiel. The subject is objects. So first, the BBC had an actually fascinating History of the World in 100 Objects. That was great. There was a podcast series, maybe you heard it. Later, there was the History of America in 101 Objects. Because, of course, America is just that much more intricate than the world, at least 1% more intricate than the whole world, of which, by the way, America is a part of. And then the Smithsonian followed up with a History of the World in 1,000 Objects. And there's this thing called Disobedient Objects. And then there's Significant Objects, which is a book by Jason Grote. I'll read a little of the Amazon description of this book. It collects the results of a literary experiment in which a best-selling author wrote a short fictional prose story about an object on eBay. Please note, in the spirit of discovery, this product has two different jackets. The customer will be shipped at random and will not be able to specify one jacket or another. All right? Great. I don't know how that helps things. There's another book called Evocative Objects, Things We Think With. Do you know the words or the phrase evocative objects literally translates to things that make you go, hmm? So we have all these objects. It's a publishing trend. It's a media trend. Everything can be explained in a number of objects. And you want to know what? I object. I object to all these objects. And my objection is this: to not tell the story of the world in 100 or 101 or 74 civilization establishing tips from the expert. I don't want to do that. I don't want to tell you about the 100 objects that created Christendom and how they can drive your lover wild in bed. That's not what I want to do. I look at history differently. I don't look at it through things. I look at it through people. I look at it through pissed off people. The history of America, the history of the world, is the history of the pissed off. The history of people who say, I object. Now I'm going to give you 10 objections that defined history. The first objection that defined history, writer's cramp. I don't need this writer's cramp. So said Johann Gutenberg. We got the printing press. Second objection, all these diseases that are killing me. I mean, I get decapitation. That should be deadly. If not, we'd be overrun by Highlanders. But syphilis, diphtheria, strep throat shouldn't kill you. I object. If your name is Alexander Fleming and you left a Petri dish out overnight, you invented penicillin. Second grade objection. Third, smallpox. Who needs it? Smallpox vaccination. In fact, vaccinations invented 1706. Great objection. Fourth, the steam engine. Really? We're still using the steam engine? Internal combustion engine. A great objection to the steam engine. But before that, hand pumps. Then came the steam engine. The steam engine itself was an objection to the thing that came before. Being lost at sea totally sucked. I object. Enter the sextant. Before the sextant was extant, you can scarcely imagine the extent of extinction. The sextant is great. Seven, now let's get to human objects. The sack of Antwerp. Okay, what was going on there was Spanish soldiers were not getting paid. The crown won't pay them. The soldiers say, fine, we'll just take our pay in the form of everyone and everything in Antwerp. And they sacked Antwerp. And it was a terrible, horrible time. There was so much savagery that all the Low Countries united against the Spanish crown, and this led to the pacification of Ghent. Now, look, I know Michael Lewis already wrote The Blind Side, but for me, he just left this great analogy on the floor. The sack of Antwerp is exactly like the rise of the left tackle, because first there was this horrible sack, and then in reaction to the sack, everyone got together, and they wanted to do something, and that led to the pacification of Ghent. And if I were an NFL lineman, and that was the position I played when I played football, I just wanted to get to the NFL. So like Shaquille O'Neal named himself the Big Aristotle, I wanted to name myself the pacification of Ghent. And everyone would say, what? And that'd be a learning moment. And I might get cut, but historians would like me. The number eight objection that I could think of, the Sepoy Mutiny. Do you know about this? I think it's Sepoy Mutiny. So 1857, Indians who were pretty much conscripted to the English army, they, to work their rifles, had to bite off a cartridge. And the rumor was that the cartridge was either made with swine tallow or cow. And in both cases, Hindus will not eat cow because it is sacred. Muslims will not eat swine because it is disgusting. Please note, I disagree with the Muslims on this point. So was it real? Was it true or just a rumor that there was tallow and swine and beef required to work these guns? Here, I'll quote you from a history text. The belief that the cartridges for the new Enfield rifle were being greased with the fat of the sacred cow and the abhorred pig united Hindu and Mohammedan sepoys against us. This was an English general writing at the time. Since the rumor was based on fact, due to an unfortunate oversight, the situation was scarcely improved by government denial, though made in good faith. Yeah, I would think so. Nine, the ninth biggest objection in human history. The crowds at Saturday Night Live. Look, I watched the season premiere. It was a good premiere. It was funny. But man, do they scream and yell at everything? Do they go over the top? Oh my God, it's Chris Pratt. Like Chris Pratt. Likeable guy. Like he was announced as the host. You know who it was. You're getting in the way of the performance. Ariana Grande. I mean, she's talented. I could definitely see her coming in second in most Bandcamp talent shows. Absolutely. But the amount of craziness that goes on. You know, I think the producers of these shows think that it gives the performers a security blanket. But to me, I just object so much when the audience enjoys something so much more than I do, so much more than logic would dictate. See also Fish concerts. See also every improv show I've ever been invited to. They're all geeked up with no place to go. Okay, history of the world in 10 objections. I'm going to give you a bonus objection. Martin Luther, famous critic of the Catholic Church, nailed the 95 theses to the wall. You know, they said he invented that or he thought of that when he was on the toilet. And in fact, I've looked this up. Martin Luther was so animated by thoughts having to do with the bathroom and bowel movements. I'm going to read to you from A World Lit Only by Fire by William Manchester. He says, for Luther, the bathroom was also a place of worship. His holiest moments often came when he was seated on the privy. In Luther's own words, it was often translated that the devil threw ink at Luther and Luther threw it back. But in the original version, it wasn't ink. It was scheisse, shit. Feces was the ammunition Satan and his adversary employed against each other. All right. That was Martin Luther objecting. And the last greatest objection in the history of the world in 10 objections. Actually, I think there were 11. You could object to that. The American Revolution. It is, in retrospect, the most reasonable revolution ever. It was no taxation without representation. That's three words and 10 syllables. It's an unwieldy slogan. It's also a very easily met demand. All right, we'll give you three seats in Parliament. Cut to 2014, and we're calling cookies biscuits. And we're dominating the Commonwealth Games. That's all it would have taken. Some guy in Parliament, the right honorable gentleman from Oklahoma. All right, that seems weird, but I'm sure eventually America would have been spun off into its own country. This indispensable nation, the shining city upon the hill. We'd have just been like a warm Canada, but it's not a warm Canada. It's America, because someone had the courage to say, I object, and someone else had the idiocy to not quite think out what the response to that objection should be. USA, USA. And that's it for today's show. Andrea Salenzi produces Slate Podcasts. She proposes that Michigan be depicted less as a mitten and more as a kitten. Andy Bowers is executive producer of Slate Podcasts. He'd like to change the shape of Belgium to something about the size of Belgium. You can listen in SoundCloud or go to iTunes. We're also on Yo. Get the app. Subscribe to Podcast. When we're ready to go, we'll Yo. Or go to slate.com/gistemail to sign up for our email to this effect. Facebook.com/SlateGist is where all our conversation takes place between me and you and Andrea. So you should go there. I'm on it just about every day, posting things and making comments and defending myself and also admitting guilt on occasion. Our Twitter feed is SlateGist. Email thegist@slate.com. And my last piece of advice is that you go to Google and put in there what European countries look like. Or go to our Facebook page, because there's a link to this video where an artist has compared countries to different animals and weird things. So I'm going to concede that, yes, Monaco does look like an elephant. Serbia, an adorable wild things type T-Rex. Slovenia, a chicken, very much so. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if the founding fathers of Slovenia owned a poultry farm and annexed the northeast quadrant that dips into Croatia just for branding purposes. But Moldova, like a ghost? Moldova, please. Thanks for listening.
This is Josh Levine, host of Slate Sports Podcast Hang Up and Listen. On this week's show, we debate ESPN's suspension of Bill Simmons. Did they do the right thing? Did they do the wrong thing? Should they themselves be suspended for suspending Simmons? Search for Hang Up and Listen on the iTunes Store or go to iTunes.com/SlatePodcasts.